Today on Maine Calling, an insider's guide to ballot measures and political campaigns. Maine voters have a long history of taking issues into their own hands with ballot referendums. Think medical marijuana, death with dignity, same-sex marriage. People who've lived here for a long time will remember the referendums over turnpike widening, the Maine Yankee nuclear power plant, casinos, clear-cutting, the proposed Dickey-Lincoln Dam, and more. For each of those ballot questions, there were political strategists trying to read the mind of Maine people and persuade them to vote in one way or another. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, a new book pulls back the curtain and looks at many of those referendum campaigns from the inside. Longtime Bowdoin political scientist Chris Potholm boils down what he's learned into axioms for anyone interested in politics. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working this summer to purchase and protect the historic Morris Farm in Wiscasset. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org. By Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Over the years, some of Maine's most consequential laws have been created through citizen referendums. What makes for a successful referendum campaign? Well, lots of strategy, polling, and messaging. Just ask Christian Potholm. Chris Potholm is Professor Emerita of Political Science at Bowdoin College. He has taught many students, managed many campaigns, and is the author of the new book, How Maine Decides, An Insider's Guide to How Ballot Measures Are Won and Lost. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a real treat.
We invite you and the audience to join the conversation. Have you taken part in a referendum campaign? Do you have a ballot measure that stands out to you for maybe why it failed or why it succeeded? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Well, Chris, thank you so much for writing this book. I've been a reporter in Maine for 30 years. I wish I'd read it 30 years ago, but, you know, never too late to start. I want to start by saying right at the beginning of the book, you answer a question that I have thought a lot about over the years, and that is, if Mainers bring forth a ballot question through the referendum process and it passes, what does that say about the legislature? Does it mean that the legislative process is, you know, out of touch with the people?
Well, unfortunately, I think it means a lot of time that the legislature chooses not to deal with very controversial issues or not so controversial issues. I've never really been able to figure out why, since that's why we send them to Augusta. But the citizens' referendum, the whole process of that has gone on in large part because the legislature chooses to kick these very controversial issues out to the general public.
Mm. Whatever the campaign is, strategists focus on demographics. We're hearing a lot about that these days. But it seems to me that the demographics that you have chosen to focus on as a political strategist are a little different. You don't really talk a lot about age groups or racial profile, but rather what you refer to in Maine as tribes. What do you mean by that, and how do these groups decide elections?
Well, in Maine, the only groups that matter in the law of large numbers are the people of English or Yankee extraction, Franco-Americans, and Irish-Americans, and then everybody else is in a fourth category, which means they're perfectly nice people with good heritage, but from a political point of view, if you can focus, as I did and I mentioned in the book, 20 to 22% of the Maine population are Franco-Americans. And since 1972, whether it's candidate elections, but more importantly, referenda, I have found that the Franco-Americans are the deciding vote. They're the swing vote. They make the difference in virtually all of the referenda I've been involved in. I never lost a referendum in a 40-year period. I never lost one if I got the Francos, and I never won if I didn't get them. So I think that, and for your listeners, I can't imagine how important they could turn out to be in the history of our country if the presidential race is as close as people say it is, and it is going to be decided by a very small number of votes, and that would probably be in the second district of Maine. And also the House of Representatives could be decided by a single seat, the second CD. So if you think about it, the 20% of the Franco-Americans who make up the population of the second district, they could decide the fate of the republic. So I don't think it's an exaggeration to underscore how important the Franco-Americans are.
Why do you believe the Franco-American community is the swing vote? What are the characteristics of this community that make this 20% a swing vote?
Well, it's very interesting in that when I started out, the vast majority of them were registered as Democrats. But over time, they've increasingly turned to become Republican and independent. But the key element is they have a psychographic profile of small business people, male or female. If you're Franco, there's an orientation toward small business. And that's why, if you think back on it, 30 or 35 people have run for governor as independents, and yet only two of them, Angus King and Jim Longley, were successful. And why were they successful? Because they put together a coalition of urban Franco Democrats and small town Republicans. That's the only way an independent has won, and I believe can win. So there is a psychographic dimension to this. And if you find themes, what I call influence vectors, if you find someone, an influence vector that will make a Franco-American switch from yes to no, or I don't know to yes, and you put that television commercial on, you're automatically going to get small town Republicans. So it's they're kind of a bellwether, they're a swing group, and the Irish Americans and some of the English Americans tend to look at government as a good thing. But if you're a small businessman, whether it's Augusta or Washington, usually government, more government means more burden to me as a small business person, whether you're a bank, a beautician or a printer or a baker. Small business tends to track very closely with the Franco-Americans.
You've said so many things that I want to follow up on. The first is that you said since 1972, the Franco-American community, as you've noticed, has been the swing vote. So we're talking more than 50 years, and I'm wondering as generations pass by, if that will be less, if your tribes will become less important, and you'll need to find a new demographic to look at in Maine.
I don't think so, because what's happened is that as Franco-Americans have become deracinated, i.e. less likely to speak French, less likely to be faithful attendants at the Catholic Church, they and many of them have become Republicans, but they've taken this psychographic of small business people and the way they look at the world, they've taken that with them. So they were critical in 1972, and they're just as critical today. And although they have switched their party allegiance, Dave Emery was fond of saying when he ran for the state house in 1974, he was from Rockland, and he said, which was a rock rib Republican place. Now he said, if he were running, he'd be better off coming from Lewiston, a formerly Democratic stronghold, then he would be in Rockland. So although they'd be in the St. John Valley, when I started out, was about 5-1 Democrat. And now, with one exception, the whole valley is represented by Republicans. But that hasn't changed the way they look at the world. It hasn't changed the way they are critical in ballot measures. In the book, I point to a number of situations like Maine Yankee, where they were the swing vote. And even when widening the Maine Turnpike, first they voted against it, then they voted for the widening. Gay marriage, they voted against gay marriage the first time, and the second time they voted for it, and if in effect passed it.
You've named some of the bigger referendum campaigns over the years, and I'm wondering if there's any thread that you find in terms of what Maine people, any connection between these issues that seem so unconnected, whether you're talking about clear cutting or Maine Yankee or same-sex marriage or physician-assisted suicide. Is there a thread of similarity to what Maine voters pass and what they reject?
I can't say that. I'm a big believer in the causal efficacy of the campaign as campaigned. I say campaign qua campaign, that you can have a good cause, but if you don't run the right campaign, you're going to lose. And sometimes you can have what's really a lose. I mean, assisted suicide, I remember that very clearly. There was a public poll when we started that was 70% of the people were in favor of it. And only 20% were against it. And yet the campaign was able to flip the equivalence of probably 30% of the vote and eventually won by a close margin. Now, eventually the legislature tackled it and it's now the law of the land. But I find over time that I've mentioned the Franco-Americans. There's another group that I do want, I mentioned in the book that I think is counterintuitive to most people. To me, when I was doing polling, the second most important group were women who worked at home. And I know with political correctness, women are supposed to be in different categories and so on. But practically speaking, if you could find themes and authority figures that worked with women who worked at home, you got a terrific advantage. One, the television was cheap. You got daytime television very cheap compared to prime time. Second of all, women who work at home tend to have the television on a lot. And so when you target the women at the home, in the home, you automatically are getting a lot of elderly people who, so if you could do the Franco-Americans and make them happy and you make women at home and then slash it for the same advertising dollar, you get the elderly. The other thing is women in the home make up their minds very much slower than people in general. But once they make up their mind, they, in my experience over 40 years, they very rarely change their mind. So they're electoral gold. You go in and get them. It's a cheap buy. You have to put in a lot of GRPs, but once you get them, they stick with you. So I always wanted to start, Labor Day. Let's go out, let's start the Francos, and let's do a lot of daytime TV.
So, Chris, this is interesting to me. Twice now you've mentioned TV and media buys and TV ads. And I'm wondering here in 2024, when many people have cut the cord and don't even own cable, a cable package anymore, watch most of their television on streaming services and no longer over-the-air broadcasts, are TV ads still as important as they used to be?
That goes to the crux of the matter, and I wake up every morning and say, thank God I don't have to deal with the conditions you're talking about. Yet it becomes so complex. And in a ballot measure, the number one thing you want to do is have control over the campaign. Today, with all the media you talked about, all the dark money groups, all the individuals popping up on the internet, it's so much different, and I would abhor it if I were still in it. Because control, whether you had 10% or 20% or 30%, you cherished that because that's what you could command, that's what you could control, and you can't always control this background noise. To me, it's a cacophony of strange things. You turn on, you look at Facebook, you can't believe all the things that are zooming across.
So what you're saying is you don't think that TV ads are as important as they used to be, but boy, if you were working on a campaign today, it would be really difficult to figure out how to get your message across.
Well, I think, for example, in the the chapter on the media, which I wrote with my son, Eric. And there's a big divergence among various consultants as to whether you need to change X, Y, Z, or all three. I think what makes a good television commercial, emotion and high production values, I think that also makes a difference in some of the alternative media. But there are lots of people. And in this book, we not only had the other five contributors, but we had, I interviewed probably 30 political consultants. And there's wide divergence on that question. I don't have the answer to it. But there are two schools of thought. One says everything has changed, and the other say, well, not all that much has changed, although you have to buy different, you have to buy different services and go at it in different ways.
All right. Well, we will hear from one of them in just a little while. We're hoping to hear from Dennis Bailey, who is one of those that you worked with on this book. Chris, I'm wondering, we've just talked about what has changed, and that is the media. What has not changed? What are some truisms that are older than you or I are? What are some things that were true in Abraham Lincoln's day that are still true today when it comes to politics?
I think that the overused word authenticity has remained the same. There is a quality to some people and to the way issues can be presented by some people that says, okay, this is real versus this is not real. And I think that has stayed pretty much the same. The other thing that I think has changed in a different way is the role of polling. That chapter that I have in there on polling really says there's no point in doing a poll unless you look for the drivers that will enable you to change somebody's position. In other words, if you're polling for the American Cancer Society, you want to know, okay, X number of people are not giving to this organization. What do they have to do to get them to give it? And if they're only giving a little bit, how do you get them to do it more? And therefore, the most important thing in a poll is the filter in which you throw out, in the case of electoral politics, you throw out the people who are lying to you and who say, I'm going to vote, and you know they're not going to vote. And you know that in my polling because we gave them three categories. I'm guaranteed to vote. I always vote. Nothing would keep me. And then a third category, oh, I usually vote. And then I don't vote or I don't know if I'm going to vote. And we just, it's much more expensive to do that because you have to throw out everybody in that third category. But once you throw them all out, then you get a much clearer sense. So you distill the electoral impact of various people and you look at what will work with the people who are actually going to show up. I've seen lots of campaigns go down the wrong path by saying, oh, we've got to worry about this third category. We got to get these people who have not voted in a long time or they're not likely to vote. We have to get them to somehow focus on this. And that's hard slogging.
Well, we are speaking with Chris Potholm, author, professor, political strategist. His new book is How Maine Decides, An Insider's Guide to How Ballot Measures Are Won and Lost. You can join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about political strategy, especially when it comes to referendums in Maine. My guest is Chris Potholm, who is professor emerita at Bowdoin College. He's taught political science to many, many students, including many who run campaigns today. And his new book is How Maine Decides, An Insider's Guide to How Ballot Measures Are Won and Lost. Join the conversation with a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Here's an email from Allison. Allison asks, I'm curious about your guest's view of the impact on election results for candidates when the bear trap referendum was on the ballot.
Well, I was intimately involved with that, the first one, but not the second. And I always thought it was almost a miracle to preserve, whatever your views, to preserve bear hunting and trapping in the 21st century. And I think the interesting thing about that election was how important the scientists were. Most people were persuaded by the argument that the bear biologist said Maine has too many bears and they become nuisance bears. They have to be harvested. Now, that was a terribly difficult message to get across, especially in Maine's first district. But I think the difference between then and now is that in the period I'm talking about, if you could get scientists as authority figures, you were way ahead of the game. And the bear biologist beat all the people who said, oh, it's not right to kill a bear. But today, since the crucifixion of Dr. Fauci and the general rise in anti-rationality, the people that are doing ballot measures today tell me that the scientist has gone in many situations as an authority figure. As we move away as a society from rationality with great hunks of the population, the value of the scientist as authority figure has diminished. And yet in the various elections that I did, the moose hunt especially, the scientists were the ones that determined the outcome because they were believable. Now they're just not believable to huge sections of the population.
I think, Chris, what Allison is asking, and it may be about the second bear baiting referendum, if that referendum being on the ballot influenced the governor's race, i.e. got Paul LePage elected governor?
No.
You don't think so?
No. Paul LePage got elected because he wasn't necessarily Trump before Trump in terms of his behavior and his boisterism with verbosity, but because he was authentic in the sense of people identified with him. And he was an extraordinarily complex person. I had him come, I try to always have the governors come talk to my class. And Paul LePage, when he came to my class, he probably 95% of the students didn't like him and were against him. He showed up in class without an aide, without the state police. He came in, he was self-deprecating, he was humble. He asked the students their questions. It was the most amazing love-in. And he got so enraptured and enthralled with the students that he invited the entire class up to the Blaine House for lunch. So this bombastic public side of LePage masked this other, you couldn't ask for a better candidate in small groups. So I wouldn't say there's any connection there. He just
I guess it's not that the bear baiting referendum maybe drew out even more conservative voters than might have voted in a gubernatorial election.
No, that remember there were three moderates in the Republican primary. Paul LePage never should have won that primary, but there were three moderate Republicans. They split the vote. I'm very careful about using the term conservative to explain any ballot measure campaigns, primarily because I never paid any attention to them. And interestingly enough, I think we mentioned it in the book that in all the campaigns I've been, and remember, I did Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. I did, you know, Bill Cohen, John Baldacci, and Angus King. And at no time did I ever remember any of them paying any attention to the party platform, whether it was very liberal or very conservative. So I think I'm not comfortable with conservative, moderate as an operational significance. Give me the Frankos and the women in the home, and I don't care if they're wildly progressive or very conservative. Now, there are some social issues, obviously, where that what I'm saying applies. But in 90% of the referendum, those ideological things are, I found, irrelevant.
On the line with us now is Dennis Bailey, former communications director for Angus King when he was governor. Then Dennis, for a long time, ran the shop Savvy Inc., and he also contributed to this book, How Maine Decides. Dennis, thanks for giving us a call.
Well, you're welcome. Great to be with you.
Yeah, always nice to hear your voice.
Chris. Yeah.
So you are in the unusual position of having been both a newspaper reporter and a political strategist. If you could go back in time, what would you tell the young cub reporter, Dennis Bailey, who was covering politics?
You know, I go back and I look at some of the things I wrote and I'm embarrassed. I mean, I covered politics for many years, but after I got into it, it was a different world to me. I learned so much more. And you said it yourself, you wish you'd read the book, you know, 30 years ago. I wish a lot of reporters had. I've actually advocated for newspapers that they should send give a sabbatical to a reporter, and put them on a campaign for a year, and then have them come back, and they would be a much better reporter, I think. I would be a better reporter now, having been, you know, exposed. And that's what we really, Chris and I, were really hoping for the book, was to sort of lift the veil a little bit to show all the things that go on. The biggest frustration for me when I was in politics with the press, or one of the biggest frustrations, was the way they treated polling. You know, they're so focused on poll numbers. And Chris can tell you better than me, but when we do a poll early in the campaign, we could care less. Well, not care less, but we aren't really looking at the head-to-head matchup. That's not important to us at that moment. It's always nice to be ahead, but we're looking for messages that will work to convince people to vote for our candidate. But the press run away with these polls, and they just do the head-to-head stuff. And it can affect the campaign. It can affect fundraising. I don't think I've ever been in a campaign at the start when I wasn't, you know, 10, 15, 20 points down. But we turned it around, and a lot of times the press were so surprised that, you know, we came back from such a deficit, but, you know, they weren't paying attention to, they were paying attention so much to the numbers that they weren't really paying attention to what was really happening with the electorate and with the campaigns.
Well, I'm gonna go off script here, and I'm gonna ask you, Dennis, given that, I want to ask you, when you watch all the polls that are coming out right now about the presidential race, how are you reading them, and how are you reading them differently than the general public might be?
Well, again, Chris is better at me at this, but I'm very suspicious of polls of registered voters versus likely voters. A lot of these polls, it's very easy or less expensive to do a poll for just registered voters. But, you know, half of registered voters don't vote. I mean, you know, so the polls aren't quite as accurate. Right now, I've noticed that the polling, they've started to do likely voters more. As they get close to the election, they start spending the real money and finding voters, and they do screening. You know, they ask people questions. Do you intend to vote? Some people ask very, very thorough questions, like, do you know where your voting place is? And if they don't know, they're not considered likely voters, things like that. That makes the polling more accurate. But I've found that in the press, the media, there's no distinction. A poll is a poll. they're not always, and there's many other aspects of polls that, you know, whether it's landlines or cell or in person, or that kind of stuff can all make a difference too.
Chris, what were you going to jump in and say?
Well, Lance Tapley wrote a very seminal article called Cheap News. And he talked about what Dennis was mentioning. And in my heyday, I can honestly say every major newspaper in the state asked me to do a poll for them. And yet they would never pay enough so I could do it what I considered properly, even if I didn't make a profit. They made money on polls, whether the polls were right or wrong. It was instant. Yeah. It was something you put on the front page. And every time we would tax after the election, any of the newspapers, you were way off. They'd say, oh, so what? They say, oh, well, a lot of voters changed their mind in the last weekend. I can say right. categorically in 40 years, I never saw an election in which a large number of voters changed their mind the last weekend. Because, and you can't prove that because nobody polls then. You know, there's no way for a poll that you can't use. So I think, if the public would distrust whatever they're seeing, you know, there's patterns and so on. But Dennis has got his finger on exactly the thing. You've got to determine who really is going to vote as opposed to who says they're going to vote.
I talk about one incident in the book when I was working for Tom Andrews, when he was running for the first, he was running for the first district congressional seat. This was back in 1990. And there was a poll, this is the June primary, and there was a poll out over Memorial Day. And I can remember the broadcaster, the TV broadcaster on Memorial Day say that, it was only 2 weeks to go before the election and only two candidates in the race have a chance of winning. And neither one of them was Tom Andrews. You know, we didn't even show up as third or fourth. And it was a poll based on a poll, which was terrible. And I went around to the press and showed them. I tried to show them this poll. First of all, it's very difficult to poll in a primary, but it was just of registered voters. And we ended up winning. And it surprised everybody. But, you know, it didn't. They just they put a lot of the other thing is they think of polls as being predictive, and they're not at all predictive, obviously. We won. That race, and we won many more, even though we were down 20 points or so.
Well, Dennis, before we let you go, I want to return to something we've sort of touched on with Chris, and that is this whole idea, you know, we're talking about polling, but obviously we've interviewed pollsters on Maine Calling, and they talk about how much harder their job is now, that people don't have landlines, and people are distrustful of any phone call that comes in on their cell phone.
Right.
And so we know that polling is different than it used to be. We've talked about media buys. The power of a TV ad isn't what it used to be. Many people don't even watch commercial television anymore. So I'm wondering, given all that, how do you believe campaign strategy is changing?
Well, social media is, like my daughter, I have a daughter. She's very up on the news. She knows everything that's going on in the news. She's never touched a newspaper, and she doesn't watch network news. But how does she know this stuff? Social media. She works for Reddit, but, I mean, she gets a lot of, it's all social media. The TikTok, my God, there's so much that happens on TikTok even. All the campaigns now are up on TikTok, they're up on Twitter, they're up on Threads, they're everywhere. They have to be because so many people on Facebook, so many people get their news almost exclusively from those sources. TV still has, and Chris will tell you, it still has sort of this, I don't know how to describe it, but it has this sort of imprimatur of, if it's on TV, it's real, where internet is kind of shaky, you can't ignore those all these other channels now when you're putting a message out.
All right, Dennis, before we let you go, and I'm putting you on the spot here, do you have any good story you'd like to share, maybe something that has not been told, of something that went horribly bad in a campaign or went really well unexpectedly?
There's plenty of bad stories I could tell. In fact, I learned more from the mistakes we make, I think, than the campaigns we lose than the campaigns we win. The only one I think of, and I'm sort of reluctant to mention it, was a case where Dan Watson, who was running, he entered a campaign to run for governor, and I helped him out, got him going, and within weeks he realized it wasn't for him, and he got out. And Dan is a really accomplished guy, as you know, he's a former Supreme Court justice, chief justice. And he thought he could do it. He hung around politicians enough. He thought he could be the next governor. And I think he would have been a good one. He's a very smart, able guy. But campaigns are different. Campaigns is not governing. Campaign is, it takes a whole other, just a whole other mindset. And I think he found out, it's very rare to find someone that is both a good campaigner and a good governor. I think Angus King fits that mold very well, but he's a rarity. And, you know, he Dan found out it just wasn't for him. And that's, and I tell that to candidates when they come to me and thinking about running. I tell them, you got to really want to run because this will take your life and it'll change your life and it will dominate your life. And are you ready for that? And some people aren't. You know, some people can't do it.
Ah, interesting insights. Well, thank you. That was Dennis Bailey, former communications director for Governor Angus King, who also managed candidate and referendum campaigns. Today, we're talking about a new book by Chris Potholm, How Maine Decides, An Insider's Guide to How Ballot Measures Are Won and Lost. If you have a question for Chris, 1-800-399-3566 or talk at mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are speaking with Bowdoin Political Science Professor Emeritus Chris Potholm about his new book, How Maine Decides. And this is about how ballot measures that have been significant in Maine's history were won or lost. If you're quick, you can share your comments and questions by an email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Chris, here's an email from Catherine. Catherine writes, one of the issues I have with citizens' initiatives is that they are not well researched. For example, how much will this cost? Who will implement the initiative? What has to change if passed?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, in my entire career, I never paid any attention to any of those dimensions. You know, you get this thing that's on the ballot and it isn't the way you would have written it. And you've certainly done very little research of your own before 80,000 people signed the thing. And so I'm the wrong one to ask on that. I do think something Dennis said is worth following up on, though, that the I mentioned this in a book, my book, the first whole chapter is about your friends will do you more harm than your enemies in a ballot measure if you let them. And I've never been with a cause people group who didn't want to do the wrong thing. And starting with Maine Yankee, where the engineers were so proud of their safety record, they wanted to do was talk about health and safety. And yet, if you talked about health and safety, their own supporters went away. This was the time of Three Mile Island. When I did the first ballot measure that brought us the land for Maine's future, and I remember going to the first meeting, and the Audubon Society had this beautiful pen wash drawing that they were going to use for the poster, and I said, "But there's no people in it." And they said, well, our members don't like people in the woods. And I said, well, we're asking people to pay $35 million. They want to be able to go into the woods. And when we did the polling, we picked up 10% because we put in provisions where people in their cars could drive to lookouts. And the people that were supporting the bond issue, that was anathema to them. They didn't want roads. And they didn't want people driving to the lookout. But, you know, somebody that's 80 years old and wants to see the foliage, they're not going to go into Baxter State Park and hike a tent into the middle of it. So your friends will always cause you more harm than your enemies if you let them. That's part of what getting control over a campaign means, getting the supporters to do what you want them to do, not what they want to do.
An email from Chris. I disagree with the notion that ballot initiatives are necessary because our legislative bodies are failing to act. Citizens' initiatives often take up complex topics that require the kind of thought, deliberation, and engagement with stakeholders that only a legislative body can do effectively, and this diligence can take a tremendous amount of time and energy. By sending measures directly to voters, we short-circuit this process and risk inducing voters to pass laws that might sound good on paper, but mask negative unintended consequences. This is precisely what has happened in Portland in recent years. Citizens' initiatives can serve an important and necessary purpose in a representative democracy, but they should be used sparingly, and the bar for getting one on the ballot should be very high. Chris.
I think that's a very laudatory point of view.
Do you think it should be tougher to get a ballot question, a question on the ballot in Maine?
I can't say that. I mean, if you have to get 80,000 people, you are going through a process that's certainly the equivalent of spending a lot of time with your local representative and then 20 more and then 30 more and then 40 more. I don't think I don't see the problem that way. Now, maybe in a location like Portland, I'm not familiar with all the things that that person thinks has gone wrong, so I can't really speak to that. But statewide, I don't agree with that.
Okay. I want to ask you a couple more things that were in your book, Chris. And one thing we haven't talked about is the role of fear. And I know that this is something that most voters will tell you they don't like. They don't like ads that are based on fear, creating a fear of something. Yet it happens every single campaign. What is your view of the use of scaring tactics to scare voters in a referendum campaign?
There is absolutely no way to do it unless you do that. Fear drives out favor. And widening the Maine Turnpike was a very good example. That was defeated by the other side that didn't want it, by these terrible things, the collapse of Western civilization, and above all, the sacred wetlands that would be destroyed. Well, by the time I got to look at it the second time around, I discovered that the sacred wetlands were actually the drainage ditches alongside the roads. And so the fear that we injected into that one is if you're stuck in traffic and you're having a heart attack and you want to get taken quickly to the hospital, you don't want to be stuck in a traffic jam. And so that fear, I remember maybe 3 weeks into our polling, we got a respondent up in Bar Harbor that said he had been against the widening of the Maine Turnpike, but now he was in favor of it because he had a bad heart, and when he got rushed to the emergency room, he didn't want to be stuck in traffic. Well, of course, the Maine Turnpike widening would have not helped him at all because he would have gone directly to Bangor. But the idea that fear drives out favor, really, when you're selling a referendum, it's not like a candidate that say, okay, here she is, here he is. With a ballot measure, you're saying if we don't do this, X will happen, and if we do do this, Y will happen. So you can call them cynically imaginary horribles, but it's the only way you drive the ballot is to make the alternative worse. People that you're absolutely right that people say invariably, oh, I don't like negativity in ballot measures. I don't like referenda that are decided. But that, in fact, is the way most of them are decided, particularly if you have a very close one.
I want to ask you about something else I learned in the book, which is that you go into a campaign believing that 5% of people are just going to vote no, and that you're going to need 60% to win. Tell me about that.
Yes, I never encouraged a client to try to put something on the ballot, speaking to the emailed person before. If you want to pass something positive, you have to start with about 60, 65%, because the other side, whoever they are going to interject this notion and they're going to drive it down. But if a person is confused and they're hearing this on that side and that the other, opposite on the other at the end, and they're just confused at the end, or they don't know how to make up their mind, they will almost always vote no. So it's better to have the no than the yes, and it's better to count on losing 5 points on that element of negativity.
Sounds like a strategy might be to try to confuse the public so they'll just vote no.
Well, it's only no, that doesn't give the public quite enough credit, or not a high enough percentage of the public to do that. But certainly, there is what we cynically call the unintegrated strata of the voting population that you do do have to give them some influence vectors that will confuse them enough to do whatever you want them to do, which is it's a kind of epitaph, really, on our national presidential race. But let's hope it doesn't end that way. We've got, what, 7 weeks to go.
An email here from Rebecca. Do yard signs have any bearing on opinions or votes? I have signs with two sides on purple backgrounds. Have faith, vote with hope on the back, and have faith, vote with joy. I'm wondering if these will just be disparaged or if they'll make anyone think.
That's an excellent question, and it depends very much on if it is a person's house and they have put a sign out on their private property. That is meaningful. First of all, it tells you you've got an issue that people care about, and it has some relevance because that person is going to vote. But all campaigns go out and hire people to put tens of thousands of signs along the road, which are, in my experience, of no value whatsoever. If you've got an opponent, you put a couple of hundred of your signs in his or her neighborhood just to irritate them, but it doesn't change any votes. The only thing that really changed votes on the ground level is going door to door and leaving something behind, a handwritten note or a door knocker or something. This is about a percentage and a half that you can influence that way. But I think the signs, if you see signs on a person's house as opposed to a crossroads, that is more meaningful. So I think it's great that this person has that and has a feeling for it and wants to do it. It's just that the 20 or 30 signs or the 400 signs, if you live in Portland, will have, I've never been able to track any impact of that.
So yard signs more important than public way signs, but still negligible impact.
Correct. They make the voter feel good, and that's an important thing. They may talk to some of their friends and actually get some votes, but it's hard to prove a cause and effect of the signs as signs.
Chris, we have just a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you about one of the ballot measures this year. We'll be doing a Maine Calling program on it. We're going to vote on whether or not Maine should have a new flag. If you were advising either side of this referendum campaign, what kind of advice would you give them in this day and age?
Well, does anybody really care? I don't know. Obviously, the people that got the signatures do. It's one that I'm a little bewildered by what was wrong with the old one. I kind of like the new one. It's simple. It's kind of like live free or die, and its looks. I don't know. It's something of a tempest in a teapot. As when you think of the gigantic social, political, and economic issues we're facing. But I haven't done any polling, so it may be very important to a lot of people. I just don't know.
So it sounds like maybe you would advise them to do some polling?
Yes. Yes, they better get going, and they better find out what will make somebody, you know, old flag versus new flag. There would be some fascinating vectors in there. And above all, who's an authority figure? When it comes to picking a state flag, who would you pay any attention to? Why would some person have, other than I like it, what else can you use as an influence factor? I like it, or I don't like the new one. I like the old one, or vice versa. No, I think I'd skip that one.
Okay, we have 1 minute left. And one thing I wanted to say is that I noticed that your book, you speak so fondly of political strategists, of people that are often referred to as operatives, when the general public has kind of an negative view of them. What would you like people to know about the kind of people who work on campaigns?
Well, when you hire a gunslinger, the purpose of the gunslinger is to get the bad people out of your town. You don't have to like the gunslinger. You just have to know that he or she shoots straight and will accomplish your purpose. And, you know, we live with the opprobrium of what hired gun means, but that's, you know, there are some people, there are some consultants, very few, who only do causes. But most political Most political operatives live for the thrill of strapping the gun on, going into Dodge, and either being shot or shoot and win and then go away. And then next time there'll be another town.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Christian Potholm, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Bowdoin College. We have been discussing his new book, How Maine Decides. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue, and Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter or to listen to past programs. Tomorrow on the program, all about Maine's iconic lighthouses. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.